This morning, we are delighted to welcome Dr. Teresa Delgado to Lancaster Theological Seminary. She comes to us in part through student testimony. Betsy Ivey and Nilda Roman, who graduated last year, had the opportunity to take a class with Dr. Delgado in the Hispanic Summer Program. And they came back and they cornered me right in front of the president's office and buttonholed me and said, "You have to get Dr. Delgado here for a lecture." And we are delighted that she was able to say yes and make room for her for this in her schedule. Dr. Delgado received her bachelor's degree in religion and women's studies from Colgate University, graduating magna cum laude. She also has two master's degrees in systematic theology from Union Theological Seminary, as well as her PhD in systematic theology from Union Theological Seminary. In addition to being an adjunct or a member of the faculty of the Hispanic Summer Program, she is the associate professor in religious studies in the religious studies department at Iona College in New Rochelle, New York, where she's been teaching since 2005, and she recently received her tenure and promotion to that position as associate professor. So congratulations. At Iona College, she teaches Introduction to the Study of Religion, Christian Sexual Ethics, Biomedical Ethics in the Christian Tradition, and Ethics and Morality. She is also the director of the Peace and Justice Studies Program, and in 2010, she won the Hugh McCabe Award for Social Justice. Her recent publications include This Is My Body, Given for You, Theological Anthropology, Latinamente, in Frontiers in Catholic Feminist Theology, Shoulder to Shoulder, edited by Susan Abraham and Elena Procario Foley. Freedom Is Our Own, Toward a Puerto Rican Emancipation Theology, in Creating Ourselves, African Americans and Hispanic Americans on Popular Culture and Religious Expression, edited by Benjamin Valentin and Anthony Pinn. And Prophecy Freedom, Puerto Rican Women's Literature as a Source of Latina Feminist Theology, in A Reader in Latina Feminist Theology, Religion and Justice, edited by Maria Pilar Aquino, Daisy Machado, and Jeanette Rodriguez. Dr. Delgado, we are delighted you are here and look forward to your lecture, Loving Sex, Latinamente, the Reality of God Through the Healing of Broken Embodiment. Friends of God, please join me in welcoming Dr. Teresa Delgado.
Thank you so much, President Lynch and Dean Malott, for your gracious introductions, and to the faculty, students, and the community here at Lancaster. It is a delight to be with you, a privilege, really, to be part of this tradition of esteemed scholars as part of the Gearhart Lecture, and I really am honored to be with you and present with you today. But I have to be honest with you. I don't know whether I can really say much about the reality of God. I certainly can't offer a full-length volume as I've seen out there, including Brian Davies' The Reality of God and the Problem of Evil, or even John Jefferson Davis's reflection on liturgy entitled Worship and the Reality of God. Because speaking of the reality of God sounds so definitive, so sure of oneself. And I am neither when it comes to my relationship with God. In fact, I'm more inclined to agree with Renita Weems when she says this in her opening pages of her work, Listening for God, A Minister's Journey Through Silence and Doubt. And she says this, No one is ever prepared to endure this long silence that follows intimacy. No one is prepared to face it when it comes after lovemaking. No one is prepared to face it when it follows a season of intimacy with God. The long silence between intimacies, the interminable pause between words, the immeasurable silence between pulses, the quiet between epiphanies, the hush after ecstasy, the listening for God. This is the spiritual journey. Learning how to live in the meantime, between the last time you heard from God and the next time you hear from God, unquote. That meantime, that holy Saturday, that middle of the road between the way things are and the way they ought to be, that seems more like the reality of God and God's presence in the world. A presence through absence, through longing and yearning, as at least that's what I've come to know, as I've tried to glimpse the reality of God. But to be true to this lecture, I am here to speak about the reality of God through the healing of broken embodiment and from the particularity of Latina experience. And I'll do just that, but perhaps not in the way that you'd expect, because I want to suggest that we can stumble upon this epistemology of God-knowing through loving sex. Yes, sex that is full of loving intimacy and affection, and sex that is enjoyed, relished, and loved. It is a journey I'd like to take with you this morning in the full light of day with the doors wide open. The more conscious, evident, real journey which has led to my passion for this topic began over 5 years ago with the concurrence of three seemingly isolated events. First, as a professor of Christian ethics and moral theology at the only U.S. college founded by the Irish Christian Brothers, the religious order at the center of clergy sex abuse of children in Ireland, I was confronted directly with the tragedy of impoverished, vulnerable children who suffered sexual violence at the hands of those in whose care they were entrusted, and in whose institution I was now serving. Second, I was responsible for teaching a course in Christian sexual ethics, and I created an assignment in which students were asked to describe anonymously how their faith tradition confronted or encountered their sexuality. The deeply introspective and profoundly serious responses spoke of their struggle as young, predominantly young Catholic men and women facing the difficulty of their own sexual self-understanding and the lack of credible resources for them through the Roman Catholic tradition. Third, in my preparation for an AAR meeting in 2007, where I was invited to participate in a panel of womanist approaches to society and culture, I researched the present-day crosses that women of color must bear, most notably the rising infection rate of HIV/AIDS and the prevalence of sexual violence via human trafficking, domestic rape, and abuse. These statistics were shocking to me, as both scourges were perpetuated through sexual violence against the bodies of African American women and Latinas. So on a conscious level, all three of these seemingly disparate yet definitive moments were begging to be recognized for the commonality that linked them: the presence of the church's authority and the use and the abuse of that authority through sex. But a deeper, perhaps unconscious journey was unfolding for me as well. And if I had never heard novelist Richard Bach's famous quote before, it now rings through my mind: you teach best what you most need to learn. And as one who survived the trauma of rape at age 17 by a Latino man 7 years my senior, never speaking of it to myself or anyone else for years, maintaining that silence of shame and guilt, I found myself in the same category as those boys sexually assaulted by their caretakers, as those Catholic youth searching for meaning and guidance in a hookup college culture, As in my African-American and Latina sisters scourged by HIV AIDS and sex trafficking, sex was not a loving experience. How can one love sex that is abusive, sex that is objectified, sex that is violent, sex that hurts so deeply and profoundly, sex that is death-dealing? If we elevate experience, lived experience, as an epistemological starting point leading to a knowledge of the reality of God, then what manner of God is known through this kind of sex? Is God present to us at all in that brokenness of our bodies being split and splintered, incisions etched, flesh forced open to accommodate the pleasure of another at our own expense? Yes, you teach best what you most need to learn. For I needed to learn how to love sex, to experience sex that is loving in the midst of a memory that will never fade and scars that will never heal. But in the process of learning how to love sex, in the process of healing those infinite wounds, of mending the broken body toward integrity and wholeness, perhaps God is realized. Perhaps God is real. As a Latina womanist theologian and ethicist, I have a responsibility to, as Beverly Harrison asserted, make the connections of sex and culture, of religion and society, of power and vulnerability. As a survivor of sexual violence, I must speak a prophetic word against anything that sanctions abuse in the name of authority, divine or human. And as one who believes that the God of Jesus, the God of the gospel, is a God of justice and life and love, I journey toward this God realization with the passion so present in the Song of Songs. I rose to open to my beloved with my hands dripping myrrh. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had departed. Gone, I sought him, but I did not find him. I called to him, but he did not answer me. More broadly, how can a sexual ethic be envisioned by attending to the lived experience of human persons whose embodied selves bear the scars of violence that the legacy of our church's doctrine of sexuality has bequeathed to us? Using methodologies emergent from liberation theology and ethics, particularly a hermeneutic of suspicion and epistemological privilege of the poor and vulnerable, my point of departure for this emerging sexual ethic is primarily the lived experience of those whose sexual being has been violated, undermined, dismissed, and commodified. Through their eyes and words, we hear the effects of what is intended to be a Christian sexual ethic that reflects the goodness, justice, and love of a creative God. But in actuality, it falls short of this ideal, not simply as a result of humanity's flawed nature, but as a result of a distorted and limited norm of the ethic itself. By hearing the voices of those whose embodied reflection of God has been broken, and for this I will pay particular attention to Latinas in the U.S. for whom AIDS and sexual violence are common and increasing, we can see that their actual realities, informed by a particular understanding of sexuality, have only glimpsed a faint affirmation of what their lives could be. As such, not only is their own human creativity thwarted, but the very fullness of their human potentiality is violated. And in doing so, we violate, distort, and limit the very being of God and the expansiveness of God's reality in our own. For our journey today, then, I'd like to focus on the way dominant society, culture, Latino culture, and Christian tradition have broken the particular bodies of Latin American and Latina women in the United States, how that mode of brokenness is undeniably sexual in nature, and that this brokenness has shaped their understanding of their sexual selves and their knowledge of God's reality as embodied. First,
we have been broken by our society. For Latin American and Latina women, the double scourge of an increasing rate of HIV/AIDS infection and continued human trafficking continues to wound and maim our bodies without any immediate recourse for remedy. The statistics for both human trafficking and AIDS are staggering. The estimates, U.S. estimates of the Central Intelligence Agency say that 50,000 persons are trafficked into the United States annually, of whom 15,000 are enslaved Latin Americans. By these estimates, the majority of these are women and children used for organized sex trafficking, which represents a $16 billion industry. According to the Centers for Disease Control, HIV/AIDS is the fourth leading cause of death among Latinas in the United States, ages 35 to 44. And I must mention then that the scourge of human trafficking and AIDS is connected, because the rate of HIV/AIDS is exacerbated by human trafficking, and those who are who have gotten the infection are not getting treated because of this underworld of human trafficking. So they're going untested, they're going untreated. So there is a connection between the two. You can't talk about one without the other. The high risk of heterosexual contact accounts for 80% of transmission for all women and adolescent girls. And while Latina women accounted for 21% of new infections among Latinos in 2009, their rate of infection was more than four times that of white women. Again, these statistics underestimate the number of Latinas actually infected, since many go unreported due to illegal immigrant status, lack of access to medical care, and the clandestine nature of sex slavery and human trafficking. We can conclude then that simply being a Latina or Latin American woman in the 20th century puts her at incredible risk of having her bodily integrity compromised by the double scourge of human trafficking and AIDS. If we are to speak of the reality of God, then we must first reflect upon who we are in relation to God and each other. This relational identity cannot be grasped without taking seriously, again, this lived historical context in which our human bodies are situated, and Latin American women's bodies, as well as those of her Latina sisters in the United States, are bodies under siege. Second, we are broken by Latino culture. Given that the majority of Latin American women and Latinas emerge from a predominantly Christian backdrop, which is infused almost inseparably from the culture, the question becomes whether the religious and cultural traditions have created conditions that allow this, what I call a double cross, to permeate and stake a stronger claim upon the lives of women. Why is it that families sell their own daughters to traffickers, when these families pray to a God in whose image we have been created? Why is it that women resign themselves to be bound to their husbands, boyfriends, or other male companions who put their physical and sexual bodies at risk, when these same women pray to a God whose grace is universal and accessible to all? So to deconstruct the paradigms of sexual doctrine that have resulted in so much brokenness, I felt the need to uncover first the ways the norms of theological anthropology of human identity in relation to God and shaped within a cultural context have problematized sexuality for women. In particular, the norms of relationality and grace as classic categories within theological anthropology have fueled a distorted sexual identity in relation to women's lives. Let me first speak about what I call the relational extremism within Latin American and Latino culture. Latin American women and Latinas learn at a very early age to put the community before the individual, the family before the self. This familial and communal experience is so central to Latin American culture that we often put our individual needs and desires aside to satisfy the needs and desires of our family. And this is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it can act as a corrective to an overly individualistic society that rewards and values competition. So our bodies become the vehicle through which a greater good is attained. But there's a shadow side to this communal ethic. The testimonies of trafficked women demonstrate that some are willing to risk their lives in exchange for the financial well-being of their own families. They convince themselves that this is only temporary, a short-term arrangement to pay off debt, to care for a younger sibling or an older parent, so that they will not have to endure the same. In other words, her body becomes the vehicle through which a greater good is obtained, namely economic salvation. Her body becomes a commodity for exchange, an exchange that can be justified when it's seen as a way of showing love for another. Right? Don't we learn there is no greater love than this? In other words, when the needs of our community are placed before the needs of the self, it's not difficult to see how this can be interpreted as a self-sacrifice, as a means to a common good, a communal good. Even the communal nature of relationality, so emphasized by Latino theologians, runs the risk of becoming a detriment when taken to such an extreme. There's also another factor within Latino culture that problematizes sexuality, and I call it cultural idolatry. The dual cultural dynamic of Marianismo, which is the idealization of the obedient woman as reflected in the Virgin Mary, so Marianismo on one side, and machismo on the other, the idealization of the dominant male hero, have perpetuated the dominant role of the heterosexist male embodied by our fathers, brothers, husbands, boyfriends, who maintain the final authority of women who must remain docile and accommodating in order to sustain calm familial relationships. Theologian Ivani Guevara speaks directly to this dynamic of sacrifice, fear, and guilt in the lives of Latin American women in whom it is instilled from a very young age to accept the imbalance of power and powerlessness between men and women. In this context, culture and religion intersect in a way that perpetuates the belief that women, in order to be considered good, must be unquestioningly obedient. And she says this, I quote, "Living in sacrifice is living in obedience to the will of the Father. And living in obedience to the will of the Father means living in obedience to his Son, represented by fathers, husbands, brothers, and men who hold social and religious power. The ideology of sacrifice, imposed by patriarchal culture, has developed in women training in renunciation. Women, in many ways, are made to serve others." Finally, we have been broken by the Christian tradition. And I like to focus on one of the fundamental tenets of that tradition, namely grace, appropriately spoken here in this Reformed seminary tradition. God's grace is universal. That is, it is available to all of God's creation at all times in infinite measure. There's nothing we can do to earn that grace. It's not in our human power to control or manipulate the grace of God. At the same time, the Christian tradition maintains that we make ourselves more accessible, more open to God's grace by our submission to God's will, our obedience to God's laws, our dependence on God's forgiveness and mercy. God's grace is God being for us in ways that we cannot be for ourselves. We are not the source of our own or others' salvation. And in this way, grace connects the lifespan of Jesus, including his cross, to our own lifespan and our own crosses. Yet, within the particular cultural experience of Latin America, the image of the Virgin Mary is upheld as the shining example of what it means to be a grace-filled human being, one who has maintained the characteristics of submission, obedience, and dependence on God's will to receive the universal gift of God's grace. Pope John Paul II's anthropological vision is inseparable from his Mariological vision when he says this: Mary's divine motherhood is a superabundant revelation of that fruitfulness in the Holy Spirit to which man submits his spirit when he freely chooses continence in the body for the kingdom of heaven. Traditional Roman Catholic theology has asserted that, quote, if every woman were made an image of the Mother of God, a spouse of Christ, and an apostle of the divine heart, she would fulfill her feminine vocation no matter in what circumstances she lived and what her external activities might be. And this is the understanding of female humanity that's been dominant in a Latin American and Latina context. So to be a Latin American woman or a Latina is to be judged against this vision of the grace-filled woman, namely the Virgin Mary, who submitted to the will of the Father, gave her body for the Son, and allowed herself to be impregnated by the Holy Spirit. To be full of grace, then, is to mirror Mary in one's own life, giving up one's autonomy to answer a larger, more meaningful call. What does it look like then when Latin American women and Latinas, shaped by these notions of the reality of God's relationality and grace, confront the scourges of human trafficking and AIDS? If she has been raised to believe that women are to emulate the virtues of Mary and model themselves after the suffering servant as a reflection of her openness to God, then perhaps she'll accept her suffering at the hands of her traffickers and those raping her body, because these are her crosses to bear. It is a distortion of a doctrine that says only God can save us. But let me tell you, it's useful when it's perpetuated by those who benefit from obedience and submission in both culture and church. If she's been raised to believe that women are dependent upon and must obey God the Father, follow Jesus the Son, and be open to the Spirit that impregnates her, she will perhaps accept the notion that she needs a male figure in her life to take care of her economically and otherwise, regardless of the way he may abuse her body. She must fulfill her conjugal duty to be open to her man's sexual needs, regardless of whether such openness will lead to her own illness and perhaps her own death. The questions in my mind that go over and over in my mind then are this: are we simply left with fragments of brokenness? Can we mend the bodily wounds? How do we make some amendment to our own bodily constitution? I do have hope, and I believe that Latin American women and Latinas can be so bold to proclaim we love sex without licensing our bodies to be exploited, ravaged, commodified, devalued, and discarded, as we have seen. She must refuse to internalize the way in which both culture and theology has distorted our bodies. She must refuse to accept both the cultural and religious legacies of her community that dictate the sacrificial offering of her body. She must refuse to allow the words of Jesus, "This is my body given up for you," to become a death sentence. I believe this refusal is only possible when we consider the intersections of human nature and sexuality as embodied by women. Our resistance to being double-crossed by our culture and our theology is the first step in the journey toward healing, initiated by the necessity of doing justice and guided by the light of love for both our culture and our faith tradition. First, a sexual ethic, Latinamente, must resist any glorification of the embodied brokenness and sacrificial suffering of Jesus on the cross as a means to a salvific end. On the cross of Jesus, we are faced with multiple dimensions of human suffering and evil, kept in place by nails and swords, penetrating the body until blood and water flows. But when viewed through the lens of Latinas and Latin American women who are faced with human trafficking and the sex trade and the compounded prevalence of HIV/AIDS, they too are wounded by nails and swords, penetrated in places where blood and water emerge. So rather than define her body in terms of sacrifice and suffering in that moment, her body becomes the ground of resistance to evil and sin. Her scars mark the territory of many acts of defiance. And if we understand sacrifice and suffering this way, then we see reflected in the pool of blood at the foot of the cross of Jesus the evil structures, relationships, and institutions that put him there in the first place. Therefore, any attempt to sacrifice her body is no longer viewed as a cross that she's called to bear, but a cross that indicts those who would impose it upon her. In this case, we must indict the traffickers, the communities that act in complicity with them, the men who pass HIV/AIDS on to their partners, the church that refuses to view condom use as a protection of life, and the list of accomplices runs long. Second, a sexual ethic Latinamente must expose the way the Catholic emphasis on the Marian ideal has created the conditions, in part, for women to accept their own self-deprecation, sacrifice, and passivity. It's not enough for us to redefine Mary simply by recasting her in a different light or showing her just to be a woman, just as we are. On the contrary, a sexual ethic that takes seriously the lives of women as embodied in their sexuality must also re-examine the Virgin Mary in terms of her sexuality. Rather than defining her body as a vehicle for the salvation and life of others, her body becomes the source and celebration of her own life as it is lived in relation. When seen through the lens of human trafficking and AIDS, a new Mariology must then challenge the presumption of obedience as a precondition for God's grace. We can no longer be obedient when faced with the defilement or negation of our own bodies. Third, a sexual ethic Latinamente must also break open the categories of sexuality and suffering. It must explore the connections between sex and pleasure and sex and suffering for women, debunking the theological and philosophical notions of the female as passive receptacle for male agency. Our inherited Christian tradition has emphasized that women's bodily integrity can only be maintained by either denying sexual pleasure as a virgin or subverting sexual pleasure for a higher good as a mother. If the tradition claims that to be a virgin is to maintain bodily integrity, then that formulation would also claim that having sex is to lose bodily integrity. A sexual ethic Latinamente must reject those binaries and transform the relationship of women to sex that is not defined by patriarchal culture centered on male pleasure or a patriarchal church centered on male holiness. Rather, sex becomes a relationship of giving, receiving pleasure as a gift to other and self. Her body, then, especially the sexual expression of her body, can be seen as an affirmation of God's goodness in creation, a reflection of the image of God in the flesh, God made real. Fourth, a sexual ethic Latinamente must also challenge the societal stereotypes and assumptions which hypersexualize Latina bodies, which cast us only in terms of the hot Latina in the tight red dress and the matching lipstick. When we affirm our loving of sex, we are doing so as an act of resistance and defiance to those who would claim this as our singular identity. On the contrary, we must refuse anything which undermines the self-determination of our sexual identity and expression in all its multiplicity, including a defiance against this warped societal interpretation of cultural biologism, which claims this image is our very being. My hope remains, then, that human trafficking and AIDS will cease to be the crosses that Latinas and Latin American women will bear as we continue through the 21st century. However, this hope cannot be realized without coming to terms with the role of sex as both physical act and way of being in the perpetuation of human trafficking and the AIDS crisis. The goal of the trafficking of women and girls is to turn a profit in the multi-billion dollar sex trade industry. And women are having sex for money, whether the money reaches their pockets or not. Women and girls would not be trafficked to the extent that they are if it were not for the potential profit they bring as women who are made to have sex with men. Similarly, the AIDS crisis is one that's reached its current levels, particularly among Latinas in the United States, as a result of heterosexual sex. Therefore, we cannot begin to recast the sexual ethic through the lens of these dual crosses without coming to terms with the implications of how sex and sexuality can be experienced by Latin American women and Latinas in a way that sustains their own bodily integrity. In other words, the journey to God must travel through the messiness of sexual terrain. To this end, I have found Margaret Farley's book, Just Love, as a comprehensive ethical foundation for restructuring a way of being human for Latin American women and Latinas who refuse to allow sex and sexuality to be exploited. Now, Farley focuses on what she calls just love, or love with justice, and just sex, sex with justice. And I would like to propose a corollary to that framework, which is what I've called, and the title of this lecture, is loving sex, because it conveys both the ground of relationality and the openness to grace as ethical starting points for the vulnerability of placing one's body into the hands of another, of affirming those words, "This is my body given up for you," with goodness, truth, right relation, and justice for Latinas. Loving sex entails both pleasure in sexual expression and sexual expression that is loving, that is expressive of a care of and for the other as oneself. In this sense, loving sex can never manipulate sexual expression in order to commodify the body by putting the body up for sale against its will. Nor can loving sex ever objectify the body by using the body as the object of another's gain. Loving sex challenges the distortion of relationality that subjugates female to male in the context of complementarity, or subjugates the needs of the self to those of the community. Loving sex is always a reflection of the image of God, whose embodied creation is good. Loving sex can never be a death sentence. It can never put a person at risk of her body or life. It challenges the distortions of grace that substitute a saving God for a saving man, a distortion that requires women to depend on another, namely a man, for her survival and salvation. Loving sex challenges the notion that sex is only acceptable for a woman if and only if it leads to pleasure for a man, and challenges the notion that good women are not supposed to admit that sex is full of delight, full of life, and even full of grace. Loving sex necessitates the belief that sexual expression is a good in itself. While it may be a means to another good, it does not have to be. Loving sex challenges the mandate that sexual expression is only moral or licit when it is engaged in for what is believed to be a greater good, such as procreation. In this sense, loving sex challenges the Roman Catholic moral, theological inseparability of unity and procreation as the foundational criteria for sexual morality. Loving sex as an end in itself challenges the distortion of complementarity as a prerequisite for relationality, and opens the possibility that sexual expression can be good, truthful, just, and loving in the right relation, in the context of right relationship that is not heterosexual. Loving sex is part of the makeup of who we are called to be in God's image. That is not to say that only those who engage in outward sexual expression are reflective of the image of God. On the contrary, loving sex points us in the direction of acceptance of those whose sexuality falls outside of heteronormativity, deemed as the only context in which sexual expression is allowed to flourish. Loving sex reminds us that the resurgent transmission of HIV/AIDS among Latin American women and Latinas has occurred, as I've said before, in heterosexual spousal relationships. Viewed through the lens of loving sex as a more accurate expression of God's reality, these scourges of HIV/AIDS and trafficking must not be allowed to continue by means of our culture or our church. Boldly and broadly, loving sex is a reflection of God's reality as relational sexuality and graceful sexuality. So the journey ends where it began. The reality of God as the God of love and life, who has spoken through the prophets, embodied in Jesus Christ, and who continues to speak to us today, is to know God, who has gifted us with the ability to generate joy, pleasure, creativity, right relation, and new life in and through our very bodies, through loving sex. Any ethic of sexuality that undermines or limits this potential for joy, pleasure, creativity, right relation, and new life is a distortion of that intention. I propose then a sexual ethic grounded in the most affirming elements of our embodied tradition, while advocating norms of sexuality that can serve as resources for a people in need of a credible guiding light from within the church. I know I need that light to guide my own way through the harrowing path of wounds, scars, and incisions that have become permanent track marks on my broken body, but which will eventually lead me back to my beloved, who awaits me with hands dripping in myrrh, who answers my call of yearning, who takes me into the warmth of a loving incarnate embrace, who is truly real, who is God. Thank you.
Thank you. That was marvelous. We have some moments for some questions for Dr. Delgado. If you just raise your hand, I'll be glad to bring the microphone to you so everybody can hear your question.
Fantastic. Cancer survivor, which was in a way inflicted on me. And I was really liberated by Flora Wollner when she said, to take up the cross and follow Jesus is never something that's inflicted on us. It's always a grace-filled, voluntary choice that God invites us to. Mm-hmm. So in your kind of dialogue there with the image of the cross, is the suffering that's inflicted on women their cross to bear, or is the cross something voluntary and grace-filled, or some of each?
Thank you for your question, and I appreciate the connection that you made to your own experience as one who's felt the brokenness of one's body. I'm somewhat resistant to dismissing the cross and following Jesus, because there's something powerful in the messiness of the cross. And I've said this in different settings where I've observed how Roman Catholic churches display a crucifix and Protestant churches display a cross. And on both, there's a danger of two easy assumptions happening on both sides. On the Roman Catholic side, the easy assumption is that somehow that suffering that is embodied on that cross becomes the axis point around which our experience turns. That is, our experience becomes reflected in that suffering. And that's all there is. And then on the other extreme of the cross without the body, without the crucifix, right? There is the assumption that somehow we can pass over Good Friday to Easter Sunday, because there is the hope in the resurrection. There is the life beyond the tomb. And that somehow we don't attend to the suffering adequately because we know that there's something that goes beyond that. And yet, in the meantime, people are suffering. And you can't just tell them it'll be over soon, because it won't. And maybe never will. So there is, I wrestle with this balance between an acceptance of suffering as a potential for grace and a reaction against being too comfortable in that allowance for grace, because then it may stop one in one's tracks. And then the danger becomes, is because grace comes from God, is this suffering coming from God? And then it's particularly through the lens of human trafficking and HIV/AIDS, is the suffering coming from God through a man and through sex with a man? So if we shift our starting point from the experience of women and see where that path leads, as opposed to starting from the point of God's grace given to all, then I think we end up in a different place. We still acknowledge that grace comes from God, but I would say that if you look through the lens of human trafficking and HIV/AIDS, and you say, God's grace is what is going to sustain me to resist this suffering, or to indict those who make us suffer. And that's a very different ending place from coming from the other side.
Thank you. As a white woman, I resonated so much of what you said and the translatability of your very grounded Latina sensibilities and how that becomes true for all women. And as a feminist who does that, I went, yeah. And then I caught myself and wondered if you could help me catch myself more of how not all women, how that translatability is unfair. And how, if you think there is a complicity of other women in that oppression.
I would say yes, there is a complicity. I'm going to put it right out there. Yes, there is. But it doesn't have to be. And I think what your first experience of the aha moment and saying yes, I hear that. I resonate with that experience, and that speaks to me, is what I really hope that good stories do. That is, they're grounded in particularity, and yet they have the potential for a transcending universal ability to communicate. And to create, and when I say communicate, meaning create those communal connections. I think the danger is, and I appreciate your attentiveness to it, when one equates one's experience, one's own lived experience, to that of another. And somehow, in doing so,
covers or disguises the power relationship that continues to exist. We can't dismiss the fact that, I mean, I think I read one of the statistics that the HIV AIDS rate among Latinas is 4 times that of white women. So I appreciate the solidarity that white feminists will be in with Latinas and other women of color. But don't be mistaken that your experience is the same as ours. And I don't say that as a way of instilling guilt or shame. I say that as a way of let's just open our eyes and attend to what's real. And know that there is a power dynamic there that sometimes that's what the danger comes. That's where the complicity comes in. When we think as women we share this experience, because there is much that we share, but in doing so, we mask the other ways that the power relationship among us, that of race and class, that of sexual identity and orientation, it gives us a certain privilege. So, but there is the potential for solidarity. Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so touched and so honored by being in your presence again, and thank you so much for being here. I was particularly touched by the remark you made about cultural biologism.
Biologism, yes.
Yes, and about the that which we assign to the Latina in the red dress and the red lipstick. I feel that there is a, and perhaps you can make the connection for me, what can women do who have been victims, as African-American women were still going through being victimized as the Jezebels from slavery, you know, our mm-hmm. bodies are the bodies of the slave master. Mm-hmm. And we're still playing that out in how we go to church on Sunday in 2012. Mm-hmm. I see it. Could you kind of put some flesh between that relationship?
Thank you, Betsy. I'm very much indebted to the work of, as you know, of womanist scholars. So, you know, I was a student of Dolores Williams at Union Seminary. I worked with her for the 12 years that I did my doctorate there. But speaking of cultural biologism, I had 4 children at the same time, so... And wore red lipstick all through it. No, just kidding. But I am very much indebted to the work that that womanist ethicists are doing to unpack the sexual the hypersexualization of Black women's bodies. And I think that my own work is still forging through that in a way that I know that there's, and it was probably the briefest part of what I spoke of today, because it's the part that perhaps needs the most flesh on the bones. Because I sense that it is the way in which, in particular, African-American women and Latinas can be in solidarity with each other, and at the same time, it's the wedge that separates us. Okay? Because there is this sense that, and it all kind of goes through the lens of patriarchy, it's a sense that for a Black man, a Latina is the best of both worlds. Okay? That she's a woman of color, but she's not going to come with the attitude that a Black woman's going to come with. I mean, these are false stereotypes that create divisions among women. But I think that as women of color, we have to start talking about that. That, I mean, we can list all of the athletes out there who didn't go the white woman route, but they didn't go the black woman route either. They went the Latina route because somehow there's, she's going to cook for me, she's going to, you know, and then they feed into the cultural biologism. So it's very, I think that we have a place where we have to create those that space of solidarity, which is why, to me, it's black women's voices who will guide my work in this way.
One last question.
Hello, Dr. Delgado. You kind of got a little bit at where I wanted to push your work and ask you about implications therein, which is that there is a vision of this woman, this Latina and Latin American woman, that may in fact prevent us, whoever the us is in culture, from acting on her behalf. And how does one disrupt that vision of her that you just described in order to make us proactive? Secondary to that is, how do we address what is absolutely post-traumatic stress that also disrupts our ability to work with one another? Mm-hmm. So I think both of those things are implications
right.
of what you said,
yeah.
if you can speak to those. And thank you, by the way, for your work.
Thank you. Leave it to you to ask me the most challenging, difficult question, which I love and appreciate tremendously. You know that I see it as a gift. Let me say something about the second part, about the post-traumatic stress. I think the title of my lecture hints at this, because even though I may not be able to articulate it very well, I think the place where we need to start is in the healing. That's where it begins. Because there's a whole lot of brokenness. That's where it starts. And so if we attend to the healing of the other first and attend to our own healing in the process, that's where I think the grace of God meets us. It's in that process of healing. So if there's any space where Latinas and African-American women in particular, and all communities who are paying attention to the necessity to heal, then something good will come out of that. Let me say then that I believe that we are resistant to our own healing. When we become identified with the victimization, because that's all we know. And we gravitate toward the places, it's like history repeating itself. Why do victims of sexual violence find themselves yet again in conditions that will abuse them when we know that that's where it's going? There's a resistance to our own healing, because that's what is known. I know how to deal with that. For a long time, that's what I knew how to do. That's how I knew how to be. I didn't know how to be any other way. And I gravitated towards those experiences that would put me in that same place, even to my own detriment. So I don't think we get there to unpacking the image until we attend to the healing. That's the best that I can do.
many people who benefit from your work, from your lectures, from your testimony, from your teaching. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your presence here. Thank you for joining us. And we thank you all for being here for this lecture this morning. Mm-hmm. And we encourage you to come back again for another lecture. God bless you. Thank you, Dr. Dorado.
Thank you.